The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be considered as professional legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. Divorce, custody battles, domestic violence. These cases unfold every day in the family court, but the stories don't end in the courtroom. The courtroom is just the beginning. This is Love, Lust, Law, and I'm your host, Michelle Locke. I've spent 23 years practicing as a divorce attorney and presided over more than 5,000 cases as an associate court judge in Texas over a dedicated family violence court. I'm also a child of divorce. And after a 22-year marriage, I've been through one of my own. When I say I've lived every side of family law, I mean it. Now I'm bringing my experience to the mic so we can unpack the legal battles fueled by love, lust, power, money, betrayal, and survival. Today, I'm joined by Jake Deptula, a seasoned victim advocate and podcaster who just so happens to be my friend and executive producer. Last episode, we broke down the high-profile yet amicable divorce of Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. We talked about how, before they announced their separation, rumors had already begun swirling that Brad was having an affair with Angelina Jolie on the set of Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Brad, of course, denied the rumors, but within months of his and Jennifer's marriage coming to an end, Angelina announced that she was pregnant with Brad's child. At that point, it became clear that the rumors hadn't just been rumors after all, because if you count months, Angelina was pregnant with Shiloh before Brad and Jennifer's divorce had officially been granted. Brad and Angelina were together for 10 years prior to their marriage on August 14th, 2014. But their marriage didn't last long. Angelina listed her date of legal separation as September 15th, 2016, when she filed her petition for divorce on September 19th, 2016. The divorce was anything but amicable. Their divorce and custody battle became one of the most toxic, drawn-out cases in Hollywood history. And I've got a lot to break down, so I want to get started. And we'll go back to 2006, when Angelina announced that she was pregnant with Brad's child. It was her first biological child, as she had already adopted two children by that point, and Brad didn't have any children. Not long after Angelina's pregnancy was announced, Brad filed to adopt her two children and formally changed their last names to Jolie Pitt. Things were moving quickly, y'all. And in May, approximately 8 months after the divorce from Jennifer was granted, they welcomed their first biological child together, Shiloh. Over the next few years, the family continued to grow. Brad and Angelina adopted a child from Vietnam and later had biological twins, Knox and Vivian. The couple also made significant financial investments, including the purchase of a 1,300-acre French winemaking estate known as Chateau Miraval. The property included a winery and a 35-room chateau surrounded by vineyards and olive groves, and it specialized in making rosé. Brad and Angelina purchased the estate for a reported $60 million through their respective holding companies, each owning 50% of the property and wine business. The brand became internationally successful, turning tens of millions in profit. In August 2014, Brad and Angelina got married at Chateau Miraval. The wedding was small, with only 20 guests in attendance. Then, just 2 years later, everything changed. On September 19, 2016, Angelina filed for divorce. In her court filing, she cited irreconcilable differences. She requested physical custody of their six children, who at the time ranged from 8 to 15. And asked that Brad, in the beginning, be granted visitation. She also asked for joint legal custody. Shortly after the news broke, Angelina's attorney released a statement to People saying, "Angelina Jolie Pitt has filed for dissolution of the marriage. This decision was made for the health of the family. She will not be commenting at this time," and asked the family be given their privacy during this difficult time. Brad issued a statement of his own. "I'm very saddened by this. What matters most now is the well-being of our kids. I kindly ask the press to give them the space they deserve during this challenging time." It is interesting to note that just within the legal filings of the divorce and the separate statements that both Angelina and Brad provided to the media, that this divorce was going to be the complete opposite of the divorce that Brad had with Jennifer. Space was not what the family received. On September 22nd, news broke that Brad was under investigation by multiple agencies for alleged child abuse. And that stemmed from an incident on September 14th during a flight home from Chateau Miraval. Details of what happened on the plane didn't emerge until years later, but according to the FBI records, Angelina told investigators that Brad grabbed her by the head, yelled at her, shook her, and pushed her into a bathroom wall during a confrontation witnessed by all six of their children. Jolie said the outburst terrified the kids. One of them called Brad a prick, and she said he responded by approaching like he was going to attack. Jolie claims she jumped up to restrain him, wrapping her arms around his neck in what she described as a chokehold. At that point, Brad threw himself backward, causing Angelina to be pushed into the plane's seats, injuring her back and elbow. She also said Brad told her, "You're fucking up this family." And when the children asked if she was okay, he allegedly told them, "No, she's not okay. She's ruining this family. She's crazy." Angelina claimed Brad had been drinking, poured beer on her, and ranted at the children. She said his behavior left her and the kids shell-shocked and described feeling frozen, scared, and unsure what to do. She said the experience made her feel like a hostage on the plane. At some point after the flight, Jolie notified authorities. Because the incident occurred in the air, the FBI had jurisdiction and opened an investigation. The Los Angeles County Department of Children and Family Services also launched its own inquiry. Both investigations took several months to complete. In the meantime, Brad and Angelina agreed to temporary custody. Both parties volunteered for individual counseling, and Brad agreed to drug and alcohol testing. He was also granted therapeutic visitation with the children, which would be determined by the family's therapist and based entirely on the best interests of the children. Here's what people don't see, is she made this claim, but there were never charges of assault against him. Because what she described as happening is assault. That what she described is Brad Pitt assaulting her, and there were never any charges. That tells me a whole lot about what happened. The fact that she said, I mean, that he grabbed her by the head, that's an assault. Yelled at her, not necessarily an assault, but could be depending on the circumstances. Shook her, that's an assault. And pushed her into a bathroom wall, that's an assault. He was never charged. When you do stuff for a living, right? And I've done this for 23 years. And I look at the news reports and I listen to the news reports. And they all come out with this horrific story of what occurred. And they typically paint one side as the bad actor or the other. This is what happened in this case, was that Brad was painted as the bad actor by about everyone. And the reality was when I was looking at this and seeing all the claims and seeing what was happening in family court, that was not my interpretation of what was going on at all. Because if someone gets assaulted on a plane like this, it's likely that someone's getting arrested. And he never got arrested. The focus was on what happened with the children, which tells me a whole lot about what law enforcement thought about the accusations. Most people that aren't familiar with what therapeutic visitation is probably want to understand, well, what was ordered for Brad? And so let me tell you about what was ordered for Brad. You know, in high conflict cases, this type of situation is very common. We commonly refer to it as family therapy or family reunification therapy. And so what usually happens is you have one designated therapist that is a therapist for the children. So a separate therapist for children. But then there's also a therapist for the family. And that family therapist will meet with both parents individually and then meet with the children. And in this case, there were six children the therapist had to meet with. And that therapist then brings in one parent with either one child or all the children into therapy so they can try and hash out whatever the issues are so that the family can heal and move forward. And so in this particular case, just based on the facts as I know them, is the court, and I don't know if Brad agreed to it or court ordered it. I don't know that. But either way, it looks to me like the therapeutic visitation was so that Brad could show the family therapist, I'm fine with the kids. I'm not a danger to the kids. Their relationship with me is fine. The issue is their mom. And so I need recommendations from you so I can see the kids. And that's the power that either the court gave or they gave that therapist was that therapist was going to determine Brad's visitation schedule with the children. And that's one of the big problems with family courts is when you get into this is you lose control over your relationship with the children at times because you're going to have a court dictate what happens and dictate who's involved in your children's lives. And it's going to dictate who that therapist is if you all can't agree. And you may get a therapist that doesn't ever want to reunify the family. I've seen it in cases where I had one therapist, a family therapist, in a particular case that I did a two-week jury trial on, that she, under no circumstances, was ever going to recommend that my client have visitation with this child. So we had to get her removed from the case because that's not the point. And then when you get a therapist like that, then you have to start all over again with a new therapist. And so that is part of the reason why family law cases can become so exorbitantly expensive is because you're paying for all these things and including attorneys outside of the courtroom. So now that we know about therapeutic visitation and what Brad was undergoing at that time, it's important to note that that agreement didn't last very long. On November 4th, Brad filed his response to Angelina's divorce petition requesting joint legal and physical custody of their 6 children. He also cited irreconcilable differences and notably made no mention of a prenup agreement. It's important to note that typically when you're filing a petition for divorce, you will include information about whether there's a prenup or not, and will usually attach the prenup to the pleading in some cases. In this case, you probably wouldn't because it's too high-profile individuals, but there's almost always a mention in a petition for divorce, a prenup, and neither party listed a prenup. That actually goes back to the thought process that we had with Jennifer in our last episode, because in Jennifer's case, there was no mention of a prenup either, and it was clear that neither one of them did. Not long after Brad filed his response to Angelina's petition, Brad requested an emergency hearing to seal all custody-related documents. Angelina said she didn't want to hide what was going on, and the court ultimately denied Brad's request. Later that month, the Department of Child and Family Services officially cleared Brad of the child abuse allegations. The FBI also closed its investigation into the plane incident and announced that no charges would be filed. In January 2017, things appeared to shift. Angelina and Brad released a joint statement announcing they had agreed to hire a private judge and would continue to work together to heal and reunify the family. They chose Judge John Oderkirk, the same judge who had married them in France. If y'all are wondering whether it is a conflict of interest for a judge to preside over a divorce after officiating the couple's wedding, I'm going to say yes, it is. I would never do it. In fact, I mean, I have presided over weddings and been the officiant in my judicial capacity for people getting married. And I can tell you, I would never agree to represent either one of them on a divorce case or even to be the private judge. You would think that the thought process behind Brad and Angelina behind it may have been, he's neutral, he married us, and so why not make him the private judge on the case? I don't know what their thoughts on it were, but it was not anything that I would have likely recommended that either of my clients do. I do think it's a conflict. I do think the conflicts can be waived. That being said, there are some circumstances where courts and other supervisory bodies, like boards, like our bar associations, can say you can't waive that particular conflict. So for a while, things stayed relatively peaceful, but in June 2018, everything changed. That month, new court filings revealed that Brad no longer had a relationship with his children, and the judge made it clear this was a serious concern. While we don't know exactly what happened behind closed doors, the court orders made it clear that Angelina was expected to make changes. The judge laid out specific times and dates when Angelina was required to make the children available to Brad. The only exception was their eldest, Maddox, who was 16 at the time. The court did allow him to decide how much time he wanted to spend with his father. Angelina was also ordered to give Brad the phone numbers for each of the children and allow him to call them freely. She was not allowed to monitor or restrict their text messages. The court also directed Angelina to set up a call with the children and their doctors. During this phone call, the children were to be told that the court has determined that each of them are safe with their father. Y'all, every time I read these quotes, it raises all the red flags on Angelina's behavior behind closed doors. The judge was clear. The children's lack of relationship with Brad was harmful. It is critical, the judge wrote, that each of them have a healthy and strong relationship with their father and mother. And then came the warning. If the minor children remain closed down to their father, and depending on the circumstances surrounding this condition, it may result in the reduction of time they spend with their mother and may result with the court ordering primary physical custody to dad.
Michelle, what kind of actions or patterns could lead to this type of ruling? And then how common are orders like these?
So I'll start with the easy part of that answer first, which is the second part. And it is not all that common that these specific findings and statements are made. And when I remember listening to this in the media at the time, and I heard the judge's comments, and because I'd done this for 23 years, I was like, oh, Angelina's engaging in parental alienation. Now, that in itself is a hot button issue. That literally could be a 2-episode podcast discussing parental alienation and whether people believe it or not. I mean, you've come down with the WHO, the World Health Organization, not recognizing it. There's a whole history of literature and sides, and the sides are on the extremes and parental alienation. But my thought on it is, if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, looks like a duck, it's a duck, no matter what you call it. And if you have children who should naturally love one parent, right? Because all children love their parents, even if there's abuse. And that's a controversial thing to say, but it is, because the children, even the ones that are abused, will think, I did something wrong to cause the abuse, and will still love their parent abuser. And in this case, it is shocking to me that Brad didn't even have his own children's phone numbers. That was huge. Because why wouldn't he? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense that he wouldn't have the numbers unless mom is specifically either telling the children or preventing the children from giving numbers to dad. That's a concern. Also, it's a concern that he did not have a relationship with any of the children, despite there being, you know, family therapeutic visitation ordered, because that's the goal of the family therapy, is to reunite the families and get them together and get them moving forward. But as of June of 18, that clearly hadn't happened either. Another giant red flag. And here's the ultimate red flag. When I heard this, I was like, oh, she's creating problems. When the judge recommended and said if she didn't change her ways, there was going to be a custody flip, which is exactly what that last line meant. When the judge said it may result in a reduction of the time they spend with mom and may result in court ordering primary physical custody to dad, that is the giant red flag that something's got to change dramatically with the children's relationship with dad. Otherwise, there's going to be what we call a custody flip. Now, what's interesting to note is the standard protocol in parental alienation cases requires, and we have what we call a favored parent and the non-favored parent. The non-favored parent is the one that the children just have cut off, right? For whatever reason. I'm just silent. The wall exists. That parent doesn't exist. And the recommended protocol for that is what we call a 90-day custody flip, which is out actually now, I think, banned in California as well as Colorado. You can no longer do the 90-day flip, is my recollection of the laws now, because this is so controversial. But what will happen is, under the normal circumstances, they would flip custody and give dad 90 days with uninterrupted time and no contact with mom to sever that kind of that bond or that attachment that makes them want to do everything mom wants, which is hate dad. Because clearly, Angelina hated Brad. I mean, that becomes evident as the case goes on. But these statements, I heard them and I was like, oh, we got some problems with Angelina and the kids. That was the time when I started to feel bad for Brad. It wasn't so much in the beginning, because like, meh, you kind of get what you deserve after what you did with Jennifer. You know, karma comes around. It always does. But when I heard this, that's when I was like, oh, I felt bad for Brad, because I've tried these cases, I've done these cases, and they are some of the hardest and most expensive cases to do. These cases are the hardest to try. I mean, the courts are really stuck. You've got a mom alleging abuse, despite no findings. Let's talk about that. The FBI didn't make any findings, didn't make any arrests. CPS didn't make any findings or issue any care plans or suggest that something should be done. They had nothing, but yet these children had no relationship with their father. And that's just not normal. It's just not. And so typically when that kind of thing happens, what some people will believe is that, well, they hate their parents because that parent did abuse to them. And then the other faction says, no, it's clearly the alienator. And then we go to court and there's a whole faction of people that say that parental alienation is a statement or ideology that only abusers use. But if you go around telling your kids you can't call your dad, or your dad is an ogre, or your dad is a mouth-breathing troglodyte repeatedly, they hear that. And so they know how you feel about their other parent. And so they know if they don't take that side with you, you may reject them. And they don't want that rejection because you're the primary caregiver. I mean, I don't care what you call it. You're not supposed to engage in that kind of behavior. As you can imagine, this ruling did not improve the situation between Angelina and Brad. Then a few months, Angelina accused Brad of failing to pay any meaningful child support for a year and a half. In a court filing, she said she planned to seek court-ordered mandated payments. Brad's lawyers filed a response just a day later and denied the claim that he hadn't paid significant support. They stated that since the couple's separation in September 2016, Brad had provided more than $9 million to Angelina, $8 million of which was a loan to help her purchase her current Los Angeles home, and $1.3 million in additional expenses for her and the children. Brad's attorney sharply criticized Angelina's filing, calling it unnecessary, omits material information, and is a thinly veiled effort to manipulate media coverage. And I got to tell you, I don't think it was a thinly veiled effort to manipulate media coverage. I think it was absolutely an effort to manipulate media coverage against Brad. But Angelina's lawyers strongly pushed back. She told USA Today, Angelina's filing was both legally appropriate and factually accurate in all respects. What has been filed by Brad's side today is a blatant attempt to obfuscate the truth and distract from the fact that he has not fully met his legal obligations to support the children. In addressing the $8 million loan, Angelina's team explained it was necessary because following the incident of September 2016, Angelina and the children needed to move from the family home, which Brad chose to keep, including all of its contents. I also find that comment interesting because that is, again, another attempt to paint Brad negatively with the how dare he kick his children and his wife out of the house and keep all the contents of it. I mean, that was absolutely done to go after Brad in the media. Her attorney also went on to clarify that Brad was asked to assist in the expense of a new home for Angelina and the children. But instead, he loaned Angelina money for which he is charging her interest on a payment plan. Angelina will, of course, honor that loan. A loan is not, however, child support, and to represent it as such is misleading and inaccurate. As for the $1.3 million Brad's lawyer cited as additional child support, Angelina's legal team responded, Angelina's asking Brad to pay 50% of the children's expenses he has not. Angelina has had to shoulder the majority of those without his contribution for the past 2 years. Child support is not optional in California. Typically, a father of means would pay these expenses voluntarily without the need for a request or court order. We are hopeful that this can be resolved without any further delay or posturing. And I gotta say, I find it really interesting that a person of Angelina's success and wealth would require her to seek child support. Do I understand that Brad has a duty to support his children? Absolutely. But typically, when you have two high wage earners, child support's really just not even an issue because both parties have enough to take care of the children. So I just find it really interesting that she chose to seek child support in a public forum. In the spring of 2019, a court ruled that Angelina and Brad were legally single, even though their divorce hadn't been finalized. Things stayed relatively quiet for the next 2 years. But in May 2021, Judge Oderkirk issued a detailed ruling granting Brad joint custody. This decision followed months of private testimony from child service professionals who had interviewed the Jolie Pitt children and others close to the family. Angelina and her attorneys were unhappy with this ruling, and in court documents, they criticized the judge for not allowing the children to testify. According to the Associated Press, they said the judge had refused to hear the minor teenagers' input as to their experiences, needs, or wishes as to their custody fate. And that was them citing California law that allows children age 14 and older to testify if they want to. Now, I don't know how the courts in California work with interviewing with children. But if the request from Angelina was that she wanted the children to testify, the teenagers in particular, in front of their parents, I can't imagine why a parent would ever want to put their children through that kind of, they have to pick a side in a forum where there are a bunch of adults and they basically have to badmouth the parent they're seeing in court looking at them to the other parent or to the judge. I don't know why you would do that. In Texas, it used to be allowed a long, long time ago. It's not now. Now we have what we call the interview with children in chambers. And so the children go back into the judicial chambers to talk with the judge, which is a much better approach than putting the kids on the stand for testimony. I just don't know why, as a parent, you would ever want to put your kids in the middle of a divorce. They're still children. I mean, that's the problem is you don't share adult issues in the marriage between children. You just are not supposed to. They shouldn't know anything about it. And that advice also goes on to adult children. You should never be telling even your adult children what happened between you and their other parent in the divorce, because kids will take sides. Kids don't understand the gray aspect of divorce. What I mean by gray is everything's not black and white, right? What is normal for a marriage for one couple is not the same for another. And kids just don't have any business knowing of it, whether they're under the age of 18 or over the age of 18. That being said, to put your kids on the stand, I wouldn't do it. And I wouldn't recommend it to my clients. Why would you want to put your child through that? One of the other issues we have in Texas is you can, when you interview the child in chambers, when the judge does, you can request that the attorneys be present and a court reporter be present to take down what the child says. To me, that is no different than testifying in court in front of your parents, because either of those parties can get the transcript and show it to the children and say, I can't believe you said this in court. People probably think, oh, that doesn't happen very often. Well, if you are in court on contested custody litigation and you are asking a court to talk to the children, it is already at that level, right? It's already at that level where a parent will go, you said this about me, and then berate the children for it. So I typically advise clients that we'll request them to interview the children in chambers or child in chambers, but we're not requesting a record. It's just not, the kids don't need that. Angelina also said that the judge had failed to adequately consider a section of the California's family code that says awarding custody to someone with a history of domestic violence is not in the children's best interest. Brad's legal team pushed back. They said the judge had determined that Angelina's testimony lacked credibility in many important areas, and the custody agreement needed to be modified per Mr. Pitt's request in the best interest of the children. They accused Angelina of deliberately causing delays, stating it would work grave harm upon the children who would be further denied permanence and stability. Angelina then challenged the ruling and filed a motion to have the judge removed from the case. She claimed he had failed to fully disclose his financial ties to Brad's attorneys, which created an ethical breach. According to her filing during their proceedings, the judge failed to disclose the cases that demonstrated the current, ongoing, repeat customer relationship between the judge and Brad's counsel. It went further, saying that Brad's attorney actively advocated for the judge's financial interest in moving over the opposing party's opposition to have his appointment and his ability to continue to receive fees extended in a high-profile case. Angelina said all of this left the judge with a conflict of interest, and in the end, a California appeals court agreed. They disqualified the judge and vacated all of his prior decisions. That meant the custody agreement reverted back to what had been in place since November 2018.
Michelle, how did this judge become appointed to their case and then all of a sudden it's a conflict?
You know, it's interesting, and I need to go look at the pleadings on this in the Court of Appeals opinion, because typically when you have a private judge, the parties agree to the private judge, right? You can go to the court and get one appointed, but in this case, it appeared that both parties agreed to use that judge. And so it's interesting to me that, one, they even use the judge, because again, I wouldn't have to begin with. But it's interesting that when Angelina didn't get the results she liked, then all of a sudden it's a conflict. The custody and divorce proceedings continued, and tensions flared once more in February 2022 when Brad sued Angelina for selling her shares of Chateau Merrival, their jointly owned winery, which was now worth $164 million. She did so without giving Brad the option to buy it first. This lawsuit was completely separate from their divorce proceeding. According to Vanity Fair, before they bought the property in 2008, Angelina's business manager suggested including a doomsday clause in the paperwork, something that would allow either of them the right to buy the other out if they ever split. But the couple rejected the idea. Brad reportedly said it wasn't necessary for two reasonable people. I'm going to underline the word reasonable people, y'all. Years later, he claimed that they had promised not to sell the shares without each other's consent. Angelina, of course, denied that that promise was ever made. Brad was prepared to buy Angelina out, but according to her legal team, negotiations fell apart when she refused to sign a non-disclosure agreement about her domestic violence allegations against him back from 2016. This goes back to my case in point about why she wouldn't agree to seal the case. She wanted the public forum to say bad things about him. And after that deal fell apart, Angelina sold her shares for around $67 million. Brad felt this violated their agreement to always offer the other a chance to buy out first. So he filed a lawsuit asking the court to reverse the sale. Angelina tried to get the case dismissed, but she wasn't successful. The legal fight over Merrival quickly became just as contentious as their custody battle. In December 2022, Angelina filed a case management statement calling Brad's legal actions frivolous, malicious, and part of a problematic pattern. She held firm that there was never any secret, unwritten, unspoken contract requiring them to get each other's permission before selling their shares. In the same statement, Angelina requested a jury trial lasting 10 to 15 days and agreed to participate in a settlement conference or mediation as part of alternative dispute resolution. Brad agreed as well to the mediation. According to the filing, Pitt's history of physical abuse of Jolie started well before the family's September 2016 plane trip from France to Los Angeles. They allege that the flight marked the first time the abuse extended to the children and that Angelina left him immediately afterwards. Angelina said she never pressed charges, explained that she believed the best path forward was for Brad to accept responsibility and help the family heal. Her lawyers described Brad's conduct as egregious and said it had caused significant and ongoing post-traumatic stress. Then, in April 2024, Angelina's attorneys filed a new motion in the Miraval case, alleging that she walked away from the deal for Brad to buy her shares in the winery because he refused to move forward unless she signed an expanded non-disclosure agreement. One, her team said was intended to cover up his abuse of her and the children, which had been ongoing for years. They wrote, "At trial, Jolie will prove through testimony, emails, photographs, and other evidence why Pitt was so concerned about his own misconduct that he blew up his own deal to purchase Jolie's interest in Miraval because she refused to agree to his new expansive NDA. Some of that evidence is currently under Pitt's control, and this is the evidence that Jolie seeks by this motion." Shortly after the filing, the judge ruled that Brad must turn over documents, including emails and text messages, as part of the case. Angelina's attorney said those materials would support her claims of abuse and reveal what he described as years of cover-up by Brad. As the Chateau proceedings continued alongside the divorce and custody cases, new allegations emerged from a former security guard who had worked for both Brad and Angelina. Brad's legal team claimed that Tony Webb, the head of the security firm previously employed by the couple, said Angelina tried to drive a wedge between Brad and their children during custody visits. According to Webb, Angelina instructed her children not to speak to Brad during his visitation time. The documents also claim she attempted to prevent Webb's staff from testifying about these events by threatening legal action based on non-disclosure agreements. Webb said he received several calls from Angelina's representative during the custody battle, reminding him that his staff had signed NDAs and warning that she would sue them if they testified in court. Webb relayed this warning to his contractors, both of whom reportedly said they'd intended to testify if subpoenaed. One of them allegedly told Webb he had overheard Angelina telling the children to avoid spending time with their father. Despite the threats, both contractors ended up testifying. Not long after that, Webb said Angelina terminated her contract with his company. It's worth noting that Webb now works for Brad. Around the same time these allegations were made public, Brad and Angelina's first biological child, Shiloh, filed a court request to remove her father's surname from her hyphenated last name. She did this on her 18th birthday. Shiloh isn't the only one. Two of the other Jolie Pitt children have reportedly stopped using Pitt altogether, though Shiloh appears to be the first to legally petition for the change.
Michelle, I think it's worth noting that Angelina actually filed a legal petition in 2002 to drop her own father's name, Voight. She's the daughter of actor John Voight, after years of estrangement with him. How do you think that this could inform what we're seeing now with Shiloh and her other children?
Well, it looks like history is repeating itself. To me, this is a classic sign of, and people don't like the term, but parental alienation. It is saddening that a child would be that estranged from a parent to say, I don't want anything to do with you. And that's exactly what she did on her 18th birthday. To change your name legally and drop your father's name is to say, I don't want anything to do with you. The other argument to that is, well, maybe he is that bad. No one knows what happens behind closed doors, is what I'm going to say. No one knows. That being said, the judge's comments in the case, as well as some other evidence in the case, makes you think that he isn't as bad as she is trying to paint him. And I think that is really an important thing to note, because then you look at, because I think it's the majority of the kids don't have any relationship with them even now. And that's just not normal. Kids love their other parent. I mean, that's what it is. And if that was the only incident that the kids ever saw, as Angelina said, that I don't know, the airplane incident, that I don't know why that in its of itself would make the children 100% reject their father. It just doesn't make much sense. So to me, it's a giant red flag, and I feel sorry for the children, because it appears that Angelina is living out her family history and imposing that same cycle on her children. And that's just not appropriate. But I mean, she's following her life past history. She's repeating it. And we're supposed to break cycles, not reinvent them. But she's going down the same path she did with her dad. In December 2024, after an 8-year legal battle, Brad and Angelina finally reached a divorce settlement. They entered into a written agreement resolving their marital and property rights, and both gave up the right to any future spousal support. The details of the settlement weren't made public, and the legal proceedings surrounding Angelina's share of the sale of Chateau Miraval remain unresolved. After the settlement was signed, Angelina's attorney told USA Today, "Frankly, Angelina is exhausted, but she is relieved that this one part is over." He added, "She and the children left all the properties they had shared with Mr. Pitt, and since that time, she has focused on finding peace and healing for their family. This is just one part of a long, ongoing process that started 8 years ago." Brad didn't issue a formal statement, but in a later interview with GQ, he was asked if the finalized divorce brought any relief. He answered, "No, I don't think it was that major of a thing, just something coming to fruition legally."
Michelle, if you had to guess on what's typical in a case like this, what do you think the settlement may have included?
So I think it depends on a couple of issues of what their settlement included, and it really relates to the ages of the children. The property is not the complicated part to some extent, although it has to be divided. There are concrete ways to divide property and assets, and deeds can be signed and contracts can be done. The children are the more difficult part of it, because if you've had children estranged from one parent to another, you can't have just a court order or the parents say, "Okay, well, we're going to start visitation tomorrow and we're going to go to a 50-50 schedule." So there's got to be some kind of buildup of possession or access to get him back to seeing. And I think it's the twins that are the last ones left under the age of 18. A typical decree or agreement is going to include a child support amount. It'll include if there's payments due to one spouse from the other for what we call like an equalization payment in the marital estate, that may be done. I mean, there are so many ancillary documents that have to be signed after a divorce. It's not just the divorce decree. Everyone thinks, "Oh, I've got the divorce decree, I'm done." No, there's usually a whole lot of ancillary documents to sign that relate to retirement accounts and other investment accounts. And then you have the tax consequences of those accounts. The decree will address property, taxes, miscellaneous, how you retrieve items from the house, right? If Brad sold items of Angelina that she wanted back, there'd be something in that order that addressed the date and time where she could go back to get the property. Otherwise, it'd be forfeited and Brad could keep it. I mean, when you've got an estate of this size, it makes the divorce much more complicated. But a divorce decree is generally going to handle property division and kid issues.
How many divorces would you say end in settlement? And then if a settlement isn't reached, what happens next?
I would say 90 to 95% of cases settle in what we call mediation or arbitration or some other kind of alternative dispute resolution. That's one of the reasons why most of the courts and most of the states mandate that you attend some kind of alternate dispute resolution, because most parties can come to an agreement. I typically find that the ones that don't come to an agreement because either one of the parties or both of the parties have personality disorders, diagnosed or undiagnosed, couldn't tell you. I mean, it just depends on the case. Even if you don't settle, you go to final trial. I mean, your case doesn't end once you don't settle. It's, "We don't settle. Okay, well, the next part is a trial." And you try really, really hard to settle cases. I know I do. Unfortunately, I seem to have a lot of very high conflict custody cases that don't resolve themselves in mediation. Because there's some issues like whether a person can move to California while the other person stays in Texas. Those parties are generally never going to agree and it's going to be a trial. But they go to mediation, you don't settle, you go to trial. And that's the way it is. Your case isn't over just because you didn't settle. That being said, oftentimes a court will order you to attend mediation again if they think it's closer. Sometimes some rulings by a court, peremptory rulings before a final trial, may dictate whether you all settle or not. Settlement can happen at any time. Settlement quite often happens on the courtroom steps before the court actually starts for that day. Or, as happened in several cases for me, you start the trial. And then mid-trial, you reach an agreement because everyone's starting to see how the puzzle's coming together for one side or the other. And so that's another thing that can happen. Settlement can occur at any time, but there are some times you just have to see it all the way through with trial. And what I caution people about not settling and about going to trial is that in trial, things are said in a courtroom that you cannot come back from. And you burn bridges. and you say terrible things about your ex-spouse. And going to court never makes a co-parenting relationship better. It's just sometimes not worth the fight. And then you have to look at what is more valuable to you, and especially in cases with children. Is it money or is it time with the children? Because sometimes, unfortunately, you're going to have to pay to have more time with your children. And I will advise clients quite often to do that, because you can always make more money, but you can't go back in time.
Michelle, what's it like for an attorney to finally close the door on a high conflict, emotionally draining case like this?
Oh, it's such a sense of relief. I've had a couple of cases recently in the last couple of years. And when you get them done, there's this overwhelming sense of, oh, thank goodness. Because the attorneys like me that do this a lot, I care about my clients. I do. I have the luxury of, I can say no to clients. Not everyone's going to be my client. I get to interview them. They get to interview me, and we decide if it's a good fit or not. But when I've got really high conflict cases, holy cow, it is such a relief to have them done, because lots of times you can't move on in life while you're in the middle of litigation, especially when it relates to your family or your time with your kids. Like, there is no peace. And having it done can give you the air back in your lungs. And so when it's done, you can leave the courtroom and it's literally, you can breathe, because you've been tense and stressed for however long that trial has been pending, especially if it's ugly.
Do you have any advice for people who are currently navigating a toxic divorce?
Jake, that's a great question. I think there's lots of different ways you can handle a high conflict divorce. That being said, some of it's going to dictate on what is the personality type of the opposing side, as well as who the attorney is on the other side. People don't realize how often who opposing counsel is can change the course of your case. And I mean, can completely change the course of your case. Clients will often ask me, well, how much is this going to cost? And I always tell them, well, it depends on who your ex so-and-so is going to hire. Because it's really true. I mean, at least in the area that I live, I can tell you very easily when an attorney gets hired, if that case is going to be much more difficult or not. So one, you know, listen to your attorney. But two, you have to be smart about the battles you pick, because not everything can be a battle. There are some things that just don't matter, and you need to let those go, because it's more important to win the war as opposed to individual battles. The other thing to remember, and this is also important, is going to court is never going to give you the pound of flesh you think you deserve. And going to court is never going to make you feel whole and like you won. It just doesn't happen. No one walks out of court happy. No one. You've just got to figure out what the right battles are. Stick with your strategy. Stick with your attorney's strategy. And the other thing I will advise is that if you don't like the method in which your lawyer is handling your case, there is nothing wrong with changing horses mid-race. I mean, really, you can change an attorney twice and be okay. You start getting to changing your attorney three or four, five times, then the courts start looking at you as the problem, not the attorney. But it's really okay to at least have one other one and get rid of the first one for various reasons. But it's okay to do that, because the last thing you want to be at or where you want to be is sitting in a courtroom and realizing that you had the wrong attorney all along.
Michelle, how common is an 8-year divorce, and what's the longest proceeding you've been a part of?
So I would tell you that an 8-year divorce would be on the lengthier side of a divorce. They just typically don't last that long. Most of my divorces are 1 to 3 years, just depending. COVID slowed litigation down for a while. So I can tell you that during at least the height of COVID, cases took a lot longer to resolve. That being said, I've got a couple cases even right now that are 4 years old that we haven't gotten a resolution on, but we're set on one of them in a jury trial coming up soon. That being said, the longest one I've had was one they were married for 5 years and ended up in a jury trial. My client won sole managing conservatorship. He was dad over a 6-year-old. And I think in that case, there were 25 different CPS investigations against dad that were always unfounded. And so the jury gave custody to my client of his little girl. And that one lasted, I think, about 5 years. And so that's probably the longest one I've had. Other than that, they're usually much shorter. That being said, there are the exceptions to the rule. But I got to tell you, 8 years, that's awful. I mean, there's nothing good about being in an 8-year divorce.
where do you even begin to fathom the cost of an 8-year legal battle with these two entities in court dealing with child custody, dealing with child support, dealing with alimony, dealing with splitting up properties? Obviously, it's contentious. Where would you even begin to estimate what the legal bills would cost on something like this?
That's the interesting part, because everyone also forgets all the professionals involved in the case. So how much was the private judge paid? How much was the therapist paid, the family therapist? I mean, there's so much you'd have to take into consideration for this case in over 8 years. And so what you probably, the analysis needs to be is how many lawyers went to court on each of the hearings, right? And I know those lawyers brought other lawyers with them to help, and they probably brought a paralegal as well. I would probably say there were 3 to 4 billable hour people on either side during every hearing. So you multiply that by however many hearings they had and the discovery process behind the scenes, and the amount would be offensive. Even on divorces that I handle, a lot of times the amount of money that is spent is difficult to fathom, especially for juries. But family law is expensive. And it's because of the nature of the proceedings, because you're getting divorced or there's a child custody case. But you're fighting over your future, and you're fighting over your future time with your children. So if you've got a really bad ex, it's going to get ugly and it's going to get expensive.
How do you deal with clients who want to be toxic?
Fire them. I mean, it is difficult enough to do the job that I do. It's emotionally draining. It's emotionally taxing. And we are more than just lawyers to our clients. We really are attorneys and counselors at law, especially in the realm of family law. That being said, if I have a client, and I make this clear usually and when I first talk to them, is I am never going to do anything that's going to harm a child. And so if your pattern and your desire is to punish your spouse through the children by telling the children things or by making sure they don't go, then I'm not the right attorney for you. And if I find out during the proceeding that you are engaging in such behavior, I'm not going to be your attorney anymore. I'm just not, at the end of the day, yes, I zealously represent my clients in their best interest. That's my job. But I'm also not going to hurt children.
What are the unique legal challenges that celebrities may face during a public divorce that, let's say, average couples do not?
Well, I think the biggest concern for, and it's public officials in general. I mean, if you're a politician, if you're in Hollywood, if you're Jeff Bezos, any of those. The biggest concern is that courtrooms are public forums, period. You can't close a public courtroom. For example, in Texas, if you violate the Open Courts Act, it is automatic reversible error on appeal. Automatic if you violate the act. So courtrooms are open to the public. And so if you are a high net worth, high profile individual, anyone can walk into that courtroom during any one of your hearings and listen to all the evidence. And once it goes on the record, it is public record, public domain. And you can get a copy of the transcript. You can get a copy of what people say. You can see the evidence that gets introduced. I mean, it really allows the public into the private aspect of your life. And it's difficult enough to maintain privacy in this modern era with everyone having a high-powered phone in their pockets with the cameras. And so really, the public forums for people that are high net worth, high profile people, your divorce will be on TMZ if you are in the public forum. That's just the bottom line, including the pleadings.
Can intense media scrutiny complicate or prolong legal proceedings, particularly in matters like custody or asset division?
So publicity, I don't think affects how long litigation lasts. I don't. How complicated it can get, I think publicity can affect for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is everything that's in writing is Exhibit A. And so if you think of some of the publicity that happens with the paparazzi and they take pictures of people with their children in various poses, how much of that comes into trial, right? If you're showing, and anyone that remembers this, Michael Jackson, where he dangled blanket over that balcony, and that kind of media coverage, publicity, would so come back to haunt him in a family court case because it just shows reckless abandon, quite frankly. And so really, media can absolutely help or hurt or complicate litigation. But I don't think it has to do with the length of the case because that's simply controlled by the court dockets as a general rule. but it definitely can throw some monkey wrenches into it. Also, social media, the comments people make, the rumors that come up, like, well, I heard that so-and-so was cheating. I remember, I go back to Tristan and Chloe. I mean, half of that was broken by social media gossip because someone saw a pic, took a picture somewhere, right? So that complicates the case. And so comments on social media can sometimes come in just depending on the circumstances. And so, yeah, can publicity affect the complexity of a case? Absolutely.
Do lawyers representing celebrities have to work closely with PR teams during divorces of this magnitude? And then how would you handle that aspect?
Oh, see, that's a tough one because you have to worry about attorney-client privilege. You're walking a fine line if you're working with the PR team because you can't reveal attorney-client privileged information unless your client authorizes you to. And then if you share it with the PR team, who are a separate entity, unless it's covered by some kind of attorney work product, then that could be discoverable from the PR agency. And so there's a definite, a fine line of what can be said to who, when, and why, because of you don't want to accidentally waive attorney-client privilege or accidentally make something public knowledge or subject to discovery that never should have been to begin with. And so you've got to be really careful when you're dealing with teams outside of your law firm when handling those types of cases.
So you would basically work from a place of discretion when it comes to PR?
I would cautiously approach with PR. I would do a lot of listening to what they have to say and what they would advise be done, as opposed to commenting on it. And then I would probably have discussions with my client without them present, discussing what I thought exactly about their tactics and whether and what the legal implications of it may be. But I would do so without them being around so that there's no waiver of attorney-client privilege. But I would probably handle it more along those lines because as lawyers, we have to do everything we can to protect attorney-client privilege. Our clients can waive it whenever they want to. That's their business to do so. But we don't waive it. We're not supposed to.
From your perspective, what lessons can be learned from the Jolie Pitt case about the intersection of family law and celebrity culture?
Oh, that boy, can it get ugly. I mean, that is, people think that's an exception to the rule on divorces. And I can tell you in my practice, Brad and Angelina's divorce is not the exception. There are lots of ugly cases just like that. They're just with regular, you know, Susie and Joe down the street. But all litigation can get ugly. And what we saw with Brad and Angelina was what happens when you've got one party that is angry for whatever reason and isn't going to take no for an answer and isn't going to let her kids go anywhere else with the father. I mean, that is a classic case in Texas that would go to a jury trial, which, by the way, it's important to note that Texas is the only state left in the country that allows jury trials for child custody and divorces.
Why is that?
Because it's Texas. I don't know why. So there's a split of attorneys that will tell you, you have a constitutional right to a jury trial, so you should be able to have one in a family law case. And then there's the other side of it that says, why would you ever want 12 people who don't understand the family dynamics and the court system and how family law works to make decisions on someone's family? I mean, you are asking 12 people to make a decision on a case that they're going to hear and know nothing about your family, nothing about the long-term implications or the nuances in family law. Why would you want them to make a decision? But then the flip argument to that is also, well, the family law system is corrupt and the judges and it's a moneymaker and it's a $1 billion industry. I've heard that on the parental alienation side that, oh, the family court system is a $1 billion enterprise. No, it's not. We aren't trying to make cases more difficult. I know I'm not in my practice. They're difficult enough that really the goal is to get them resolved as efficiently, effectively, and to the best result for the family long-term that we can. Making it worse doesn't benefit anyone. And what happens in family courts affects the very fabric of our society. It affects how often children see either parent. It affects your future money down the road. It can affect your ability to earn. I mean, what truly happens when you go to family court is the social fabric of our society. And so it shouldn't be handled by just people that have no clue what the implications are. That being said, you're also asking a black and white law, like statutory requirements and the rules and the laws that we have to operate under to make decisions or to guide decisions on what is purely matters of the heart. That makes it that much more difficult to do when you add that part of it into it. So the people that complain about the family law and the family court system don't, I guess, realize that there isn't really a good solution when you've got black and white laws that have to apply to matters of the heart. Now that we've discussed the facts surrounding Brad and Angelina's divorce, I want to share and give a little bit of insight into how I would have handled each side to the divorce. And I'm going to start with Brad, because I think Brad in this case was the good guy, which is a different role than I think he had in the divorce with Jennifer, where he was probably had more of the bad hat. One of the things that you often do when you've got cases where you want it out of the public eye, and you agree to, at least in Texas, we call it agree to seal the case. Sealing the case is a very difficult standard that really, unless both parties agree to seal the case, it's not likely to get sealed. There are some specific elements varying on whatever state you're in to seal them, but typically it's very difficult absent the parties agreeing. Oftentimes in cases, if you want the other party to agree to seal the case, you're going to have to pay for it. And pay for it either through some financial agreement or pay for it through something with the kids. And that sounds terrible, and it does, but I'm not going to say it doesn't happen. But there is a value to privacy for some of these people. And I think that is a strategy you could have employed in if you were representing Brad. That being said, I don't think given the circumstances and what we know about the case now, there was any price that Angelina was willing to accept to take this out of the headlines. Despite some of the allegations that she made against him, he really kind of, for me, had the white hat because he came in, as I would have probably advised him to do, especially knowing that there was a plane incident, there have been multiple investigations. You have to look at what a court's going to do, and a court's going to do everything in its power to protect the children, no matter who's on either side. It's going to say, I understand what you want, Dad, I understand what you want, Mom, but I'm going to look at what's going on with the kids, and I'm going to make sure they're safe. So because early on in the case, they didn't have any actual conclusion of the investigations or anything else, Brad did exactly probably what I would advise him to, is we're going to agree to about anything they want because we're showing that you have a mea culpa. Whatever happened on the plane is not what she's saying. That being said, we understand there was an incident that probably wasn't appropriate on both sides. And we're willing to take some ownership of it because ownership goes a really long way if you're in court. If you have an alcohol problem or a drug problem and you know you're going to court, you better come to terms with your issues before court, because if you go into court and you know there's going to be credible evidence presented that you've got some kind of substance abuse issue and you go into court and say, no, I don't, you lose all credibility. And when you are in court, credibility of the witnesses is everything. You know, I talk about you don't always need a police report to file a claim for domestic violence or say you've been assaulted. You don't necessarily have to have that to prove that in court, because it really does come down quite often to the credibility of witnesses and the credibility of what your story is and whether it makes sense and whether you look like you're telling the truth. And so when I represent someone like Brad, we're going to go in with, here are solutions to fix the concerns that you may have, Judge. Like, we will already have a plan in place. And we'll go to the judge and say, Judge, we understand this. Here's the issue. We understand your concerns. And here's what we're proposing that we will do to get us back to where we need to be with the children. And because you try to go into court with clean hands, you really do. And if you are reasonable in your approach, you usually come out ahead. I mean, clients, I think, get frustrated at times because they see opposing sides misbehave or they see opposing counsels misbehave. And I tell them, like, I understand, but it's not necessarily effective in court, because you have to remember these judges, they see people day in and day out. They see the same lawyers day in and day out. They know what the lawyers all do. They know the good ones. They know the bad ones. They know the ones that exaggerate. They know the ones that don't. they know all, the judges know all these things. It's the same group of attorneys for the most part when you really get into the lawyers that do nothing but family law. The judges know them all. They know all the players. And while the opposing counsel may be doing something like that in court, if your attorney is telling you, hey, that's not really that effective, and let me tell you why, you may want to listen because that attorney is going to have a better feel and idea of what's going on because they've probably gone against that opposing counsel multiple times. And so representing Brad for me would be really going in and being as reasonable as possible given the circumstances. Now, there are times when your reasonableness needs to end. And I think that's what happened with Brad when it came down to him not seeing the kids for an extended period of time, like having no contact. He didn't even have the kids' cell numbers. And at that point, he had had enough and he went in and made some demands. And I think you are reasonable to a point until it's time to no longer be reasonable because what's going on is not appropriate. And, you know, I think the studies will show that the kids should have both parents in their lives, that they do better when they've got two parents that love them and are involved. And so when I represent someone like Brad, it's very much reasonable until we're done being reasonable. And then we go swing the big bat in court to show that the opposing side is really the issue. And what's important when you have someone like Brad is you use your communications or you advise someone like Brad and their communications to the opposing side. You tell them how to communicate so that you get any answer to the question you send to them in correspondence is either going to help your litigation case or it's going to help the children. And either way, it's a win. And so there is an art form to communicating with your co-parents if you've got one that is like what was existing in this case, which was not even giving dad phone numbers to his kids. I think his position would probably have been one of the harder ones to handle in this divorce because you had someone on the other side that wasn't worried about the public perception. And so because of that, he was on the defense more than he was on the offense because he had no choice. Because you had someone that would continually file motions in court alleging facts that may or may not have been true. I mean, you assume when you do a file of pleading in court that all the facts that you put in the pleading are accurate. That being said, Brad was more on the defense than the offense. And some people think that that's a bad position to be in. And I'm going to tell you, sometimes it's really not. And it's a strategy point because you always, as a general rule, so not always, but as a general rule, you want to go into court with clean hands, which means you want to be reasonable. You want to show the court that you're willing to follow the court orders, that you're willing to do what is appropriate given the circumstances. And that is what was seen early on in the divorce with Brad, where he went in and he agreed to a temporary possession schedule, agreed that a family therapist was going to come in and recommend what his possession or access should be. He acknowledged there was an issue, whatever that issue was, and said, okay, I'll jump through some hoops. Because that's what you do. You show that you're reasonable and you're going to make reasonable decisions and you'll behave reasonably in the litigation. And the long term, while it stinks to be the good guy always, because you always think, well, the bad guys win. Because in court, sometimes it seems like the people that are the uglier tactics get ahead of the other side. But in the long run, what I find typically is that if you are reasonable and really go into court with the clean hands in the litigation, it becomes very apparent to the judge what is actually happening in the case. And that is actually what we saw when, as the case progressed, because we've heard from, as I discussed, the court's ruling that basically admonished Angelina about her behavior, especially when it came to the children and how the children interacted with Brad. So I think what happened was as the case went on, because Brad was the reasonable one, and I think you can show that he's reasonable based on what he did with his first divorce with Jennifer, is he was reasonable. And I think that was who he probably really is a reasonable guy trying to get to a reasonable resolution. And that is very much a strategy I would have employed if I had represented him. Let's just be reasonable. The problem is if you have someone on the other side that is unreasonable, it makes being reasonable exceedingly difficult to maintain because you get tired of what is going on the other side. And so when I have cases like this, I tell my clients, just hold on for dear life. Whatever your higher power is, whatever you believe in, hold on to it till we get through. I know it seems like it's not working, that the approach is wrong, but oftentimes a reasonable approach gets you where you need to be. And I talk about this because in family law, and it's a cliche that I use all the time, but it's lots of four-letter words and fair is not one of them. And when we look at the case analysis, at least on this particular case, it looks like, well, it wasn't fair to Brad. They picked the private judge and the private judge ended up getting disqualified. I ended up reading the Court of Appeals opinion on that. And basically, the judge was disqualified because he had failed to disclose some clients, and they weren't clients. He was a private judge on some other cases, but didn't disclose those particular parties, and they happened to be represented by Brad's attorneys. And so technically, it was a conflict because he didn't disclose it. And so that's the reason why he was disqualified. Doesn't necessarily mean that what he thought about the case or the findings he made when he made Brad a joint managing conservator or gave him joint custody, I think is what they called it, doesn't mean the rulings were necessarily wrong. I mean, he heard all the facts that were presented in that trial and he made them, but he technically didn't disclose a couple of the cases that he was assigned to as a private judge. And so that required his dismissal from the case. But you have someone, when you were looking at Brad and Angelina, who Angelina won the public forum. Now, if I was representing Angelina, I probably never would have agreed to a private judge. I would have made everything public and done it we're going to try this in the public arena to get the public perception on my side. That being said, her attorneys know a lot more than the public knows. And so if you know you have a client that may have some undesirable qualities, let's just call it that, and they have undesirable qualities, we like to put a turtle shell over our clients to try and contain those undesirable qualities. Or we try to put some lipstick on the turtle shell. So, you know, it's like the old proverbial, what happens when you put lipstick on a pig? And so when we have a client that we have some undesirable elements, whatever those elements may be, we do our best to hide, secret, cover, or help them change before we have to get to court. And one of the reasons, if I'd been her attorney, that I would have agreed to a private judge is because I had some knowledge of some undesirables that I didn't want in the public eye. So I think Angelina's litigation team probably did it the best way. I think it's also interesting to note on Angelina's side how many different attorneys either got added to or removed from her legal team during this time. When you start changing horses mid-race, it starts raising some eyebrows. That being said, changing one or two, not that big of a deal. But when you start changing a multitude of attorneys, you start looking at the client being the problem, not the attorneys. Now, attorneys specialize in very specific areas. And so she may have had to bring on some attorneys for the business issues related to Mary Vol. She may have had to bring on some additional attorneys on the appeals because not all trial attorneys do appeals. For example, I don't do appeals because it's not my favorite thing to do. I like being in the courtroom. I like talking, obviously, because I do this for a living now. But yeah, appeals are not for me. But she did an appeal. And that appeal was an extensive appeal just based on what I saw on the Court of Appeals response on it when they handed down their orders. But representing Angelina, it's provided you didn't have any undesirables, I probably would have tried it in the public court system. The only concern about that is you put it in the public court system, then everyone knows about your assets. Everyone knows your deeds become public. It's a public courtroom. Anyone can walk in, as we've learned from the Diddy trial, anyone can walk in and watch when you're in a public courtroom. So it really depends on what she wanted to put at stake. And that one is a lot of it is client-centered on what is best for the client, because sometimes clients cut off their nose despite their face. And you have to make sure that you're able to advise your clients of, I understand why you want to do it this way, but I'm going to suggest this and here's why. And so our job as attorneys is really to explain to our clients, here are all your options. Here are the possible consequences for these options. These are the options I would recommend based on the following, but you get to choose. Because at the end of the day, it's not my life, it's my client's life. And they're going to have to go sleep with the decisions they made at the end of their trial or the end of their case once they reach a settlement. And so for me, I would have done as public as well for Angelina, because it applies pressure to the other side. And then when you get enough pressure, then agree to do a private judge. And then if you get a ruling you don't like from the private judge, then you get to appeal that in a public forum, which is exactly what she did. And so I would guess that if the ruling hadn't gone against her, there would not have been a request to disqualify that judge. Angelina, I really think, and this one has the black hat. I really do. She made a bunch of allegations. And they were allegations because there was never any formal charges. There were never anything that said Brad did wrong. And the evidence to me of the kids dropping Pitt from their name once they hit 18, particularly Shiloh, is not a normal thing for most kids to do because most kids equally love their parents. And so you kind of wonder what happened behind closed doors with Angelina. That being said, I think Angelina's attorney's approach was good. I would have done the same thing. I would have absolutely tried it in the public arena, especially right after the incident, because that's when he was being investigated. CPS or Child Protective Services in California was investigating. And so there were investigations. And so the momentum was very much against Brad at that point. And so that's what they did. They filed in court. They did the public filings and they did the aggressive approach because it's how dare he make her a victim, which is how you would play it. And that's what they did. It's what I would have done. But then I think they got smart because they eventually agreed to a private judge. They wouldn't agree to seal the case, which I think is interesting. And I think that's because when you've got someone with the kind of facts that Angelina had, at least in the beginning, is you definitely want the public forum because that applies more pressure on Brad's side to settle so it goes away because they don't want the public exposure. But if you've got someone with Angelina who may have some undesirable traits is what I'll call them. You kind of want to cover them with like a turtle shell, right? Like you just want to cover them and so that no one sees through the turtle shell and there's some undesirable things. And if there are undesirables, you don't want that in a public courtroom either. And so that may be the time where they agreed to use the private judge, which they did. And what I think is important to note is that I don't think there would have been a request to disqualify the private judge if she had won in that ruling, but she lost because the judge gave Brad joint conservatorship or joint custody, and she didn't like that. And so then we come to the appeal, and the judge gets disqualified. And my understanding from the appellate opinion is that's what it should have happened because there was just some non-disclosure. Didn't seem to be, to me, like a huge non-disclosure, but non-disclosure is non-disclosure, and family law is guided by the laws. And so the judge got recused, but I don't think, looking back at it, that if Angelina had won with that private judge, that there would have been any appeal on that decision. But it's interesting because they didn't seal the case. They kept their options open. So if Angelina didn't like any of the result, she could have gone back to court. And that's exactly what she did. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. I'll be back with a brand new episode. And remember, there are lots of four-letter words in family law, and fair isn't one of them. Until then, I'm Michelle Locke. And this is Love, Lust, Law. Love, Lust, Law is hosted by me, Michelle Locke. Jake Deptula is executive producer. Haley Gray is producer, writer, and researcher. Jared Landis is sound editor and mixer. Want to reach out to me? You sure can. You can email me at hello@michellelocke.com. You can also find out what I'm doing on Instagram at Attorney Michelle Locke. Just remember, Michelle is spelled with one L, and you can thank my mother, Margot, for that.